My featured musical this evening is a 20th anniversary tribute to the New York premiere of Roadside, based on the play by Lynn Riggs, with book and lyrics by Tom Jones and music by Harvey Schmidt. It opened at the York Theatre off-Broadway on the 29th of November 2001, where it played for a one-month season. And we shall be listening to the York Theatre Company cast recording. But to introduce the musical and to talk about its genesis, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program, via Skype from his home in Connecticut in the USA, the Tony Award-nominated lyricist and librettist, Tom Jones. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing very well indeed. Well, I guess if Lynn Riggs is remembered for anything these days, it's as the playwright of Green Grow the Lilacs, which was the basis of the subsequent Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, Oklahoma. And looking at your website, jonesandschmidt.com, I was interested to note that you were actually in a student production of Green Grow the Lilacs when you were at the University of Texas.
Yes, I did, at college. I played a cowboy. I think on the website there's a picture of me with snaggletooth, unshaven, and doing my best to look as butch as possible as a West Texas cowboy. By the way, I would recommend, you may not have noticed this, but an interesting thing you may want to check out on the website under the Jones section.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing called a trip to Texas.
Yes.
And you didn't check that, I wouldn't imagine. But it was on my 90th birthday, and I took my two sons down to the panhandle of Texas to show them the world where I was born and where I grew up the first few years of my life. And the terrain is really kind of maybe not so impressive to somebody from Australia, but generally speaking, it's a very distinctive thing. And there's pictures that we took in a town called Muleshoe, Muleshoe,
yes,
Texas, about 10 miles from where I was born. And I think looking at some of those pictures and maybe reading some of the captions or showing them might be something that was interesting, because it certainly relates to my feelings about Lynn Riggs and about Green Grow the Lilacs and about Roadside. When I was in that production, I was just switching over in drama school from being an actor to hoping to become a director. And the man who was teaching my directing class was the director for this big full-stage production of Green Grow the Lilacs. And he had a hunch that I could pull it off, and he gave me his two leading actors and had me stage one of the major love scenes of the show.
Yes.
And that was a really important event in my life, starting me, really giving me some more confidence as a would-be director.
Yes. And following on from Green Grow the Lilacs, how did you become interested in Lynn Riggs' play, Roadside?
And then Roadside, the Green Grow the Lilacs experience, about two or three years later, I was in graduate school as a director, and one of the things we did was we got to do one full-length play. For a week's run or something like that. And a roommate of mine had found this play by Lynn Riggs called Roadside. And he showed it to me and read it to me, actually. He was from a town called Sweetwater, I can't think of the name of it right now.
Yes.
But it was right next to that place, Muleshoe. And he had grown up in that world. Later, he went on to become a U.S. ambassador to a number of countries in Africa. But anyway, he was so persuasive and so exciting that I decided to do that. And that was the first full-length play I ever directed.
Yes, yes.
And it really went very well. And then based on how well it had gone, I was just graduating, as I say, from my master's degree. And we decided after the production was in the spring and the summer when we were all out, we decided to do a summer theater production in a little local professional theater area they had there.
Yes.
And to make a musical, or at least write 7 or 8 songs for it. And I had done this college musical with Harvey Schmidt, and so I went to him, and he wrote 3 or 4 songs, and I turned him down. I thought they were too contemporary sounding.
Yes, yes.
And they sounded too much like Bernstein.
Oh, right.
Which is a good sound, but not for West. Anyway, and I did it with another guy who was nowhere near as talented as Harvey. But anyway, and we did that. And then later in New York, when Harvey was like prospering as a commercial artist and I was starving as a would-be director, we started trying to put together stuff to make a real musical out of Roadside.
Yes.
And we got a few songs, and a fellow Texan from the University of Texas was a friend of mine named Fess Parker. I don't know if you know that name.
Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, yes, indeed.
That's right, that's right. Well, he had just signed on with Disney and had just done the Davy Crockett thing, and it was this phenomenal success, as you know.
Yes, indeed.
And much to the despair of all of the raccoons in the United States.
But
anyway, we played him some of his songs, and he loved them. And he wanted to do a Broadway musical using our songs and more, adding more. And he was such a huge name. We went to the agent. I can't remember names now, but anyway, the woman who was the agent for the Lynn Riggs estate.
Oh, yes.
And they loved the idea of Fess Parker, you know, of course, naturally. It's just like money in the bank.
Indeed, yes.
But they didn't like the idea of Harvey and I.
Ah.
Because we were really unknown. We hadn't done the Fantastics or much of anything. And so they tried to persuade him to let them take it to Rodgers and Hammerstein or somebody else. But he really wasn't that interested. He liked this, and he was willing to hold out for this. And in short, it never happened. But we wrote a lot of good songs, and we put it aside for maybe, I can't count, 40 years or something like that.
Yes.
And at some point, like so many things, like almost everything I've ever worked on, it had a structural problem. But 40 years later, for some reason, I was going through things, and there it popped up, and I read it. I thought, and listened to it from the tapes. Thought, my God, this has got some wonderful stuff in it.
Yes.
And I thought, I think maybe I know how to solve the structural problem. So we rewrote it and did what is basically the Roadside that now exists.
And the opening tableau with Uncle Billy's Traveling Tent Show, that sort of puts it into the context of a show within a show.
Well, as I think I probably talked about a little bit on the video, you've looked at the video on the website,
certainly,
right?
Certainly, yes.
Yeah. But also on the album, I wrote a section about the fact that growing up in West Texas, the only theater we ever saw, there was one company that did a tent show that came by when all of the rural communities in the summertime and set up in some field and did a what they call Toby shows.
Yes.
The character, the lead, almost all of the things were either based upon or adapted to feature, to star a rural backwoods, supposedly dumb redhead character named Toby,
mm-hmm.
who turned out to be smarter than the city slickers. That was the whole thing.
Yes.
And Toby, as I realized later in life, as I studied drama, was really an archetype going back really to Plautus, at least, you know?
Yes.
With the clever servant who's smarter than the others.
Mm-hmm.
And also, then he was always redheaded. So I think there is a significant character, I can't remember his last name, but his name, first name is Toby,
mm-hmm.
in She Stoops to Conquer.
Oh, yes, yes. Toby Lumpkin.
And who is simple-minded but turns out to be smarter than everybody else. So I'm sure, like in the 1700s and early 1800s, that play playing around in regional theaters and so forth, and that character being very popular, particularly in an American environment,
mm-hmm.
And particularly then in a rural environment later on.
Yes.
So those were what we saw. They stretched the model quite a bit, actually, because, for example, one of their famous plays was The Fall of the Alamo.
Okay.
And guess what? There was Toby there fighting and dying at the Alamo.
Yes.
These things, you know, they were wonderful entertainments because it was still the heyday of vaudeville.
Yes.
So that between each of the acts, all of the actors would come out and do their specialty, like a tap dance number or play an instrument or yodel or something, you know?
Yes, yes.
And then midway through, then they always had a big drawing. They sold Cracker Jacks. And there was a prize in each and every package, including some things where people would go up on stage and they had a special Cupid doll and all that, you know.
Yes, yes.
Anyway, to just conclude that little section, I thought later when I was studying drama and Shakespeare in college and all that, that this must have been very crude. I loved them growing up. You know, they were a revelation to me.
Yes.
But when I was a senior in college, I went to visit my grandparents up in the Panhandle near Muleshoe.
Mm-hmm.
And an eccentric Texas millionaire, of which there were quite a few at that time,
yes.
decided he wanted to see one last Toby show because
mm-hmm.
they had ceased being, you know, with World War II, that wiped out the Toby shows, really.
Yes.
And so he had the money, and he assembled the famous company, the one that I had seen growing up, which was an actor and a company named Harley Sadler, S-A-D-L-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
And they did one last Toby show, and I was able to go see it.
Mm.
And I was stunned by the brilliance of this actor. He could have been, I mean, that performance was like a great performance, like a Bert Lahr performance in a different genre.
Yes.
But truly something to be treasured and remembered.
Yes.
Anyway, so.
So the framing device of Uncle Billy's Travelling Tent Show was your idea. How many characters did you take from Linerig's original play to put into the musical, or how many did you eliminate?
I eliminated more than I took in.
Mm-hmm.
The characters are the same as in the Linerig's play, except there are two other characters which I eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
There was a judge in a courtroom scene, which I eliminated that and gave his part basically to the marshal, trying to make it economically feasible for a smaller production, you know?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And then I also, later on, not at first, but later on, we developed it, and we did it at York Theater. And then a few years later, we did a little revival of it there. And the director at that time helped me to take two of the characters called Red Ike and Black Ike,
mm-hmm.
and have them also double playing other people, playing ladies from the town and this and that and whatever.
Yes, yes.
As might conceivably have happened in a small rural company like that.
Mm-hmm. And Red Ike and Black Ike were the vaudeville double act doing the vaudeville routines.
They were in the original play, yes. And then, but as I say, we not only gave them like two of those in one, with there were olio numbers, mm-hmm. like they used to have in the theaters where they bring down, they stop the show, roll down an olio with a painted something, and you do a number in one, that little space in front of the olio and the footlights on the edge of the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave them two numbers. One is
looking at the moon,
the moon, mm-hmm. and the other is
My Little Prairie Flower.
My Little Prairie Flower, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very fond of the songs and the score. I think it's a really good score myself.
Mm-hmm.
But it was poorly received, and it was a very good production, actually. Though, as you can hear from the album, particularly the woman was extraordinarily talented.
Yes.
And the whole little orchestra they assembled, those were really good people. Some of them actually were regulars on the famous Garrison Keillor show, you know, Prairie Home Companion, which had really top-class musicians.
Yes.
But I tried to figure out why it was met with real active hostility by a lot of the critics.
Oh, curious.
I mean, it's always one looks for excuses. But the truth is, looking back at this holds up. If you hear that album, mm-hmm. that's a damned good album. I mean, it's really, it's fun and it's touching and it's classy.
Yes, yes.
And it didn't deserve... I mean, it was really, they went out of their way to be hostile.
Mm.
So I figured out it opened in December of whatever that would, 2003 maybe?
2001.
2001.
Mm-hmm.
Time flies when you're having fun. I mean, but what had happened right before that is that a Texan, a so-called Texan,
mm-hmm.
George Bush had, in effect, really stolen the U.S. presidency.
Yes.
Because the popular vote went to Gore. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but it was being handled through the Supreme Court. But they were, rather than finishing the counting of the ballots,
mm-hmm.
they went ahead and decided. In other words, it was a real, I thought, a shame.
Yes.
And a lot of people felt that. And at that point, Texas really had a bad name. And that, and for other reasons, the behavior of most of, or an awful lot of Texans in my adult life has been, I think, shameful. And, you know, no wonder people are hostile.
Yes.
So I think that was a real big part. They were not interested at that point. And they also... they didn't understand the humor of it in a way.
Yes.
So yes. It's never really played down where it might be appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if anything will ever happen from it. But it's good enough that if it could just stick around, the wheel turns and it'll get a fair shake, you know. But I think the hostility towards Texas humor is going to be last a long time.
I see, yes. I suppose it's ironic in the sense that it's an inversion of Oklahoma in that the heroine ends up with a bad guy, sort of equivalent to Laurie ending up with Judd Fry in Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that's interesting about Judd Fry, originally called Jeter.
Yes.
Both of these plays are extraordinary, I think. Mm-hmm. Green Grove of Lilacs and Roadside. Roadside particularly has structural problems I was talking about, like some of the climactic scenes take place in scene two rather than scene five, you know?
Yes.
And things like that. But his, Lynn Riggs' appreciation of and gift for recreating the patois of rural Southwest right before the 20th century is extraordinary, I think. You know, I talk about that and give some examples of it in the video, which I hope you'll feel free to use. Anything on the at all that we have on the website, we're hoping people will use it and will refer to it and will re-show it and so forth and so on, you know.
Yes, well, I'll give the details of that to my listeners later on. So after they hear the score of Roadside, they can look up your website and see your video introduction to the musical.
By the way, I wanted to ask you.
Certainly.
Given the Western milieu and the tall tales and so forth, I think some of that might translate to Australia, given the some of the kind of like open space and what they used to call in Texas, as I write about, and then I also talk about, but mainly in the notes for the album, is the Ringtail Tudors. And there's a history of that in Australia, I believe, too. Or am I wrong?
In the context of tall tales, is that what you mean?
Yes, right. Like, you know, but telling them not just to be braggarts, but to make fun of them at the same time they're telling them.
Yes.
To enjoy the exaggeration, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes. As the character of Texas describes his origins in the song Borned.
Yes, right. Yes. Mm-hmm. So he's Crocodile Dundee, but with a lot more sense of humor.
Yes, yes. I remember years ago seeing the Disney cartoon. I think it was Melody Time, and they had Roy Rogers and the Sons of the Pioneers singing the saga about Pecos Bill.
Yeah. Yes, right, right. Yeah. I think that was for a Disney film. They were taking, like, Pecos Bill, yes.
Mm.
I mean, they were... I'm trying to think of some of the other famous ones, but yeah. But it was a not uncommon thing just among the people to, like, in the same way that some of the sexual verbal teasing and so forth, that there's a kind of like teasing, making fun at the same time you're also somewhat being serious, you know?
Yes, yes, indeed. Sort of back chat and innuendo and that type of thing.
I love Hanny. She's a wonderful character.
Mm-hmm.
But I recently saw again a film that I had loved so many decades ago called The Sundowners, which you've seen, I imagine.
The one with Robert Mitchum and Deborah Carr.
Deborah Carr, yes. And I think something about her resilience and toughness with tenderness is related to Hanny in a way, you know?
Yes. Yes, about the pioneers who had a tough way of life and they have to have humour to offset the sort of rough conditions that they experienced at the time.
Right. But that raises an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing, not just at the time I was putting together the website, but continuing day to day, today, yesterday, tomorrow, a lot of some of the best writing and stuff that I've done ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's surprising because it's not supposed to happen at this age. and I'm surprised, but I'm getting a lot of this stuff written.
Mm-hmm.
And as the pandemic is not drawing to a close, but maybe slowing down, I face the problem of re-entering the world and, like, dealing with not only my own physical frailties, but the problem of hearing. For example, as I work with actors in the hopes of getting some of these shows on their feet. Of course, it's better, like, in person. It's just simpler and more direct.
Yes, yes.
Because if you have the hearing aid and you have the phone, that's like two devices it's having to get through. But I'm really facing it quite literally within the next 10 days, 12 days. We've done a really interesting reworking and redoing of what was the musical of The Tempest, which we call La Tempesta.
Right.
But turning it into a musical called Prospera.
Ah, okay.
And some interesting stuff coming from that. And now we're putting together a new showcase work tape so people who might be interested can hear what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a very talented black woman singer, but she's a great singer, much better singer than she is an actress, although she's okay.
Yes.
But so she's in New York before going back out on tour again, working with the composer, and I need to work with her as an actress.
Yes.
And I've given up my apartment in New York. I haven't been to New York 2 years, not since the pandemic.
Mm.
So it's like I have faced that, and then we have also coming up a presentation of the musical Harold and Maude,
mm-hmm.
with this very talented young man, if I can remember his name, young guy who took over the lead in Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway when he was still in high school.
Oh, yes, yes.
And he's very interested in doing this read-through staging of Harold and Maude, and he would be wonderful. But again, it's like I just have to somehow find my way out of not just the pandemic, but my physical limitations to be able to contribute more than just what I put down on a page, you know?
Yes, yes. And I guess keeping active and keeping involved in theatre keeps you young, too. The word retirement obviously isn't in your vocabulary.
Right, right.
Great. Thanks once again, Tom Jones. It's been a great delight as usual, and I look forward to catching up with you again in the future. And in the meantime, good health and great success with your future projects.
And happy Thanksgiving to you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom.
Bye.
Bye for now.
Bye.